Hi, I'm KALW News Director Ben Trefney, and I want to let you know that we are in our spring membership drive. So I want to invite you to support KALW. We are listener-supported radio, and so we're asking for your help right now. Please go to the website and click Donate Now. It's at kalw.org. You'll feel good about it, and we will too. Thanks.
KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland.
I'm from Cleveland Heights.
West Oakland, California.
Rome 58.
I actually don't live in Oakland. I live in Richmond.
Coming up, we'll hear how the Warriors are planning on retaining some of the flavor of Oakland when they move to San Francisco next year.
Are they going to want to use different ingredients that are cheaper? Because if that's the case, I don't want to be involved. But it wasn't the case.
How Bake Sale Betty got into the Chase Center. Then we'll talk about authentic food with the San Francisco Chronicle's restaurant critic, Soleil Ho.
Everyone has their own idea of what's authentic. Everyone has a grandparent, right? Everyone has that reference that no one else has. That seems closest to the truth.
Set the table. A hot, fresh plate of Cross Currents is coming right up. The Golden State Warriors are on a roll now. Last night, they crushed the Portland Trail Blazers in Game 1 of the Western Conference Finals. We've been following this playoff run with an original podcast called Bounce, the Warriors' last season in Oakland, because win or lose, the team is leaving for San Francisco next year. And it's going to feel different, that's for sure, but it's definitely not all bad. The Golden State Warriors organization is trying to retain some of the culture of the home it's leaving behind and finding ways to improve the fans' experience at the same time. In the latest story from our podcast, KALW's Liza Veal has more on that.
It's halftime at Oracle Arena, which means fans are lining up for expensive, largely terrible food. Soon they'll be full of sad, salty concessions and regret. On Yelp, the Oracle concessions have a 1.5-star rating.
If I could give 0 stars,
says one reviewer,
I would. Oracle Arena has the worst food in the Bay Area, and I go to a lot of events.
The garlic fries are described as
bland and cold.
The Korean rice bowl tastes
chemically and frozen.
A bunch of reviewers refer to an apparently indescribable weird taste. Many of their accounts end in food poisoning.
Come on, Oakland, this is pitiful. Hopefully food will be better at the Chase Center.
Well, listener, guess what? It almost certainly will. The food vendor in charge of the new stadium is Bon Appetit Management Company, and they're doing things differently. They've invited a bunch of tried-and-true Bay Area food institutions to open branches at Chase, including Oakland's Bake Sale Betty. The hope is that the halftime crowd will feel more like this boy.
I have a good feeling, sorry.
Do you have a good feeling about the food you're about to eat?
Yes.
What is it?
I don't know.
It's easy to feel inexplicably good on this corner of Telegraph Avenue in Oakland, where everyone's waiting in line or dining on food from the tiny storefront known as Bake Sale Betty's. Miles Smith says he eats here at least once a week.
It's just so simple. It's just one thing, you know, like if you come here, you know what you want.
You want buttermilk fried chicken. You want it crispy on a bed of bright, herby jalapeno coleslaw on a soft bun.
Everyone likes fried chicken. Who doesn't like fried chicken? Look at the diversity of people. I mean, look, it's beautiful.
What Diane Young likes about this place is the character. The owner, whose name is actually not Betty, but Allison Barakat, and her staff, create a real sense of familiarity.
She talks to us. She loves kids. She brought her kid. She's got purple hair.
And it's humble. They do a few things, and they do them well.
It's small, but it's efficient. You know, they got a train going, they're open for 4 hours, they know their customers, it's awesome.
Bake Sale Betty's was originally just baked goods, which she sold at farmers markets, until she met her future husband 17 years ago.
He was at the Danville Farmers Market when I set up the first week, and we met there, fell in love, moved in together, teamed up, and grew the business, and now we have 3 kids and a dog.
At the shop, Barakat works the sandwich station. It's elevated behind the registers, so she and the other chefs can greet and chat with customers, which they do, a lot. I saw her and her staff give away more cookies than I could count.
Am I good?
You're good, Grandpa.
Now, I love to make someone's day. I really do. Not because I want them to go on social media and tell everyone, but because I want to make their day.
Yeah.
And I want them to say, wow, who does that?
Yeah.
No one does it.
Yeah.
I tell Bearcat that my dad, who lives 10 minutes away, always thought he was her favorite customer because she gave him free stuff so often.
Which he is. I don't know his name or who he is, but I can tell you right now, he's definitely my favorite customer.
But this little storefront plans to respawn itself in a very different environment, one that wouldn't seem likely to nurture the pursuit of fine foods or the intimacy of this corner. It's the Chase Center. And over there, Betty's will have to be supersized while trying to somehow remain true to itself. Here is Chef Bearcat.
It's not going to be the same, but I want it to be kind of a branch of that spirit so that it's not institutionalized. I would love, my dream is that, you know, the people taking the orders smile and say hi.
Bearcat was approached by Bon Appetit when the company was first putting together a bid to oversee food at the Warriors' new spot. The pitch was to serve the food of beloved, iconic local spots like San Francisco's Taco-licious, Sam's Chowder House of Half Moon Bay, and in an homage to the Warriors' history, they wanted to revive Hall of Famer Nate Thurman's acclaimed Big Nate's Barbecue. That Oakland connection is also why Bon Appetit wanted to import Big Sale Betty's to Chase.
So we had to do a tasting, so Bon Appetit gathered us all together, and we had to present our food to the owners of the Warriors and the Chase folks, and after they did all the tastings, Bon Appetit got the contract. So that means we were included.
Were you automatically into it, or what were your concerns initially?
I wasn't at first. The first red flag was, are they going to want to use different ingredients that are cheaper? Because if that's the case, I don't want to be involved. But it wasn't the case.
Bearcat is very particular about the local, largely mom-and-pop suppliers of her ingredients. Everything from the olive oil to the parsley to the flour, which she assumed Bon Appetit would not stay faithful to.
Because it's unheard of, typically, that in an arena set that you would have that, because it's mass-produced, and that's not how we operate here.
But the arena paired up with Bon Appetit specifically to get top-notch, locally sourced cuisine. They agreed to replicate everything about the ingredients and production of the food.
And so I was all in at that point.
There will be 4 Bake Sale Betty concession stands at the Chase Center. They expect to have to turn out 275 sandwiches during the 15-minute halftime. That's how much they do in an hour at this shop.
So yeah, I got my work cut out for me logistically.
But luckily, the operations will all be run by Bon Appetit. Bearcat will help train the staff, and she'll commute over for quality control purposes. But she hopes to eventually be able to stay more or less hands-off.
It's a nice way of expanding without me committing 100%, because I am 100% committed physically and mentally here, where I actually have to come to work every day. But at Chase Center, there'll be more assistance. So if somebody calls in sick, I'm not the person covering them, which is what happens now. So that will be nice.
Opening up at the Chase Center means she's about to have a whole lot more quote-unquote favorites like my dad. But what I want to know is, will the Chase deal make her rich?
I have no clue about that, because we don't have any projections. So right now it's kind of like, how long's a piece of string?
Yeah,
there's no answer right now.
She says the institutional support means she has a much better shot at profitability than most restaurants do. The Oakland shop was underwater for years.
We should be rich now, but we made some mistakes along the way that we're still paying for, and we were undercharging for our food for many years, and just overinflated payroll, and so many things that can shut a business down that we were able to get a hold of earlier on, which is why we're still around. This is our 14th year in business.
And the extra income may mean she won't have to spend all her evenings baking and all her weekends making sandwiches.
I just want to be able to pay the bills without breaking out a sweat every month. And we do that now, barely, but we do it, and we're getting better at it. That would be nice.
Bearcat and Bon Appetit haven't set prices yet, but if ticket prices at Chase are any indication, Warriors fans may experience sticker shock at the concession stand too. But this food might actually be worth the money.
That's KALW's Liza Veal, and that story was from the latest edition of KALW's original podcast,
Bounce, the Warriors' last season in Oakland. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And also save the date. This Tuesday, May 21st, KLW is hosting a live Bounce event. It's going to be at the 81st Avenue Branch Library in East Oakland. We'll have a video version of the podcast, lots of guests, including reporters you've heard on Bounce, and free food. That's next Tuesday evening. Find all the information at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. The San Francisco Chronicle's restaurant critic Soleil Ho is a self-described ethno-food warrior who writes on what she calls the fish sauce beat. She's Asian American, queer, and writes about the intersections of culture and food. And she's revolutionizing the world of restaurant and food critiquing, right down to what words she thinks are outdated and offensive, like the term she's constantly fighting, ethnic food. Soleil's work also focuses on how gender, class, and race affect our eating and food culture, history, and writing. She came by our studios, and we had a chat about the foods we grew up with in our immigrant families, like this Sudanese dish I love but brought me a lot of teasing as a kid. It's called molokhia. Molokhia here, when we buy it, what's written on it is Jews mellow?
Oh, is that the herb, right?
It's like a green leaf. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we make it into like a stew with meat. Either we dip bread into it or we eat it with rice. Mm-hmm. And it is very green. And it is a stew that it has this texture of being gooey a little bit. And we love it, right? And so I don't remember who it was from my friends who came over and immediately was like, you know, the green slime.
Yeah, it's mucilaginous, right? Like okra.
Yes.
Got it.
Yes.
Cool.
It ends up being that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And interestingly enough, now I'm finding it at the farmer's market.
Very cool.
Like some Asian communities use it as well. Mm-hmm. But what about you? Did you have that kind of two worlds of food thing?
Sort of. So my parents and grandparents were from Vietnam. They were refugees. And so as part of the deal of being accepted into the United States, they didn't have a lot of stuff. They didn't have a lot of resources to bring with them. And so they also got placed. They didn't get to choose where they ended up. Mm-hmm. And so they ended up in the middle of nowhere in Illinois. No offense.
Mm-hmm. Illinois is great.
But that meant that they didn't have access to the ingredients that they were able to understand, you know, like fish sauce or even rice noodles, that sort of stuff. They had to drive 3 hours to Chicago to get that. What also happened was they ended up relying on donations from church, food pantry stuff, welfare, and that meant they ate a lot of American ingredients, American foods. And so I grew up eating Wonder Bread, Coca-Cola, that sort of stuff. And my family shaped those foods into a paradigm that they understood.
Like how?
So on our trips to Chicago, for instance, they would buy like the Maggi seasoning.
Oh, yes.
The fish sauce, all of those elements, mm-hmm. and would marry those elements with the foods that were very American. For instance, you know, banh mi, the sandwich, I think that many people know now. Mm-hmm. For us, it was a slice of toasted Wonder Bread, Braunschweiger, like from the grocery store, that little Oscar Mayer-like chub of liver. And a little bit of butter and Maggi.
That was the banh mi?
Yeah.
Oh. So you didn't have two worlds of food. You had one world that was mixed.
Yes. To me, I think that's an interesting story as well because we compromised a lot with food. And we, you know, when you think about fusion, for instance, mm-hmm. it is like a white gaze applied to ingredients from elsewhere.
Right.
But for me, how I grew up was the gaze of, I guess, the subaltern, right, or of people of color, where we are looking out into this world that is very white and trying to understand it and shape it to our understanding and our paradigms, our frameworks. And that, to me, feels very revolutionary, where we are trying to shape this white supremacist world into something that we understand that we can accept rather than vice versa, which is the more typical narrative. So, you know.
Which is what your grandparents were doing.
Yes.
At that time.
And I think we don't appreciate that enough. People who write about food, food from communities of color and food from immigrant communities. I think this narrative has often been we are shaped by the environment. But I think thinking about the ways in which we shape our environment in turn is also very interesting.
Oh, for sure. And that makes me think about, you know, just like fast forward to today. Right? We're in the Bay Area, lots of diverse restaurants with all kinds of foods, and the communities who make it, you know, you can get your quote-unquote authentic. What do you think about that also, kind of Americanized versions of food versus authentic versions of food? What are your feelings about that?
I think when you are striving for authenticity, you're always going to lose. Everyone has their own idea of what's authentic. Everyone has a grandparent, right? Everyone has that referent that no one else has that seems closest to the truth. And I think this is also, I don't know, I think this fits with like my philosophy on truth as well, because we all have our different versions of what is true. And to fight over what is authentic and what is not tends to just be an assertion of like whose truth is more truthful. And to me, it is just a futile task.
And according to whom?
Like
who gets to be the judge on that?
Exactly. And nostalgia, I think, crystallizes our memories in a way that reality will never live up to. And that's why authenticity as a yardstick of quality just doesn't feel fair to anyone.
One thing that's so refreshing about you is that you have this honesty and this transparency. Your latest review was of a restaurant that I love. I live in Union City, so all about the Union City, Fremont, you know, Hayward area. And you reviewed Jine Jine. And I was just like wondering how you decided that I'm going to just tell things like they are. I'm going to say in this article that I don't know much about Burmese food, right? And I'm going to be that person that's going to be like vulnerable and honest and just tell it like it is as an approach. How did you decide on that?
I think it's really risky to do that, especially as a woman of color in a position like this, where I am pressured to be the expert, because otherwise I would be making everyone who thinks I'm not qualified correct. Because I am very different compared to people who have come before me, just demographically. And so, you know, whenever we break into these industries that are very homogenous, there can be a lot of pressure to exceed, be twice as good.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I don't need to tell you that.
That's a pressure.
And so for me, the most revolutionary and strange thing to do would be to admit that weakness. And it was a gamble. Because otherwise, you know, people could be like, oh, wow, what a dummy that she doesn't know like such and such food. Or why are we listening to her? Why are we reading her work if she doesn't know anything? So I had a lot of anxiety going into that. At the same time, I also got a lot of feedback from some readers who were uncomfortable with not knowing. And that's why they didn't go to restaurants that didn't fit into their own community, you know, like.
Because you also talk about, you've noticed people shy away from restaurants or food they can't pronounce.
Right. And I think there's a complication to that, too, because my family's names are unpronounceable to people who are not Vietnamese. You can learn how to pronounce them, just like they all learned how to say the word February when they came here.
Or Tchaikovsky.
Right. Or Tchaikovsky. Or the word chronicle. You know, it is possible. And so I wanted to model that behavior and just say like, no, no, like we learned and you can learn. You know, I think if we're going to try to be better for each other as a community, then we should be vulnerable too.
What's wrong with the term ethnic food?
It's a practical thing. We all have an ethnicity. We all have height. We all have eye colors. We all have bodies. And so it's, to me, ethnic food is just, it's strange because doesn't all food have an ethnic background? But if we're using that term to refer to only some kinds of restaurants, then that's just white supremacy.
And we're othering.
Yes. Mm-hmm. To use the term in that way just, I think, calcifies racial categories. It puts forth this argument that only some people have an ethnicity of note mm-hmm. as well. They're not default.
Mm-hmm.
And to use that term feels really benign, but at the same time, you are just affirming that they are different.
Do you think you're revolutionizing restaurant critiquing?
I don't know if true revolution is possible under that framework. In the end, I don't know. It's not like anything's being burnt down. In the end, I am providing a service. I work within these limitations that, I don't know.
Decolonizing?
I think decolonizing is complicated, right? Because in the end, I am also a settler.
Hmm.
I don't know if it's possible for me to do it.
Do you carry any condiments with you in your purse?
Oh, my gosh. No, because all I have is chapstick. Chapstick and a book.
So, Leho, thank you.
Thank you.
So Leho is a food and culture writer, podcaster, and the San Francisco Chronicle's restaurant critic. Find out what she has to say about restaurants in your neighborhood. This music is by Sunny and the Sunsets from San Francisco. They're performing at the Chapel in their hometown tomorrow night.